Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Finsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. This episode is part of a new series exploring sustainability and fashion, created in partnership with Ralph Lauren. Throughout this series, we're inviting key leaders, academics, creatives, and entrepreneurs to share their stories and views on the challenges and opportunities of today's fashion industry. We'll look at how brands, influencers, and media can pull together to deliver much-needed positive change and explore the collaborations and innovations shaping a more sustainable future. This series is inspired by Design the Change, Ralph Lauren's global strategic roadmap to create timeless style, protect the environment, and champion better lives in line with the G7 Fashion Pact and the United Nations Global Compact. My guest today is Oliver Steeds, founder, chief executive, and mission director of Necton, dedicated to the exploration and protection of the ocean. By his own admission, Oliver is a rather average submersible pilot, and depending on who you ask, is either part Captain Nemo, part Steve Zissou from The Telegraph, or a leading ocean explorer from The Economist. Since launching Necton in 2015, his missions have served to help protect an area of ocean equivalent in size to twice the entire United Kingdom, as well as discovering over 100 new species and confirming the discovery of the rarefotic zone, one of the largest new ecosystems found on the planet in decades. Prior to Necton, Oliver was a critically acclaimed international investigative journalist and a presenter of major historical, investigative, and adventure series for Discovery Channels and others. His expeditions, reporting, and adventures have been in over 100 countries. He is also the co-founder of the educational nonprofit Encounter EDU and the Oceans Academy, an advisor to Project Zero, and occasionally gets seasick. Welcome, Oliver, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Now, I want to go back to where it all began. You started off as a journalist and have led expeditions. You've lived with tribal people and had more adventures than most people have had in several lifetimes. Where does your passion for exploration, adventure, and uncovering new truths originate?
That's a good question. I think sort of going back into, we don't want to go too far back into my mind because it's a strange place to go, but it all probably stems from something similar with everyone. You know, it's curiosity. And my mother tells the story of me being about 5 or 6 years old and climbing a tree with a brick and jumping out of the tree to see which would hit the ground first. I just learned about gravity, but I wanted to try and understand it a little bit better. And, you know, I'm not, back then I wasn't, and I still am not a particularly intelligent person. So I jumped out of the tree with this brick and ended up with a head injury. And she reminds me at that time that she had to take me to the hospital and whilst having my head stitched up, told me about Newton and said, look, if you do want to be curious, then you need to be a bit clever about it and try and use an apple next time instead of a brick. So that's kind of where it all started, I suppose, with curiosity, seeing a closed window and wanting to go through it and seeing what's over there. That's what really sort of drove my initial passion for it. But then, yeah, that started to change into wanting to have an impact with that. You discover something new, so what? You want to do something with it. You want to try and have a positive impact on the world.
So what led you from journalism to oceanography? That's not a traditional shift that you see in many people's career paths.
Well, to be honest, I came to it quite late. I'd spent most of all my time as a journalist reporting on land, and I was sent on an assignment up to a place called Lamlish Bay on the island of Arran, the west coast of Scotland, to look at this small marine protected area. And I was lucky enough to dive down onto the seabed and witness what was going on. And there was this one area which was protected, which is a lush jungle, if you like, an algal forest full of life, teeming with a whole range of animals which I couldn't even recognize. And then just outside that area, which was protected, was an area of devastation that looked like a desert, which is where there was a huge amount of trawling going on for scallops, industrial scale. And a scientist at the time, Callum Roberts, who's now on our board, is a brilliant marine scientist, sort of helped me understand it. And how he described it, I think, really captures what we do when we trawl the seabed. It's as if we get a massive bulldozer on land and we drive it across the countryside, felling all the trees, destroying all the farms, scooping up all the wildlife just to catch a couple of cows. And that's what we're doing on our seabed when we're trawling it. And we trawl a huge amount of our seabed, far, far more than we do on land, which has massive devastating effect. It's like clear-cutting land, destroying the undersea habitats, those really critical nurseries for fisheries, for example. And when I saw that, I suddenly realized, crikey, what else don't I know? You know, I spent the last few years previous to that reporting on the underreported issues going on in our world, you know, whether that's terrorism issues or corporate political corruption, slavery, and all sorts of other nasty things that were happening. But I had no idea what was happening to our planet, to our ocean. So that was a real trigger for me to investigate further, which then led me on to setting up Nectum to try and do something about it.
So I'd like to pivot now to the nexus between the fashion industry and ocean health. As you know, a historic moment in the sustainable fashion movement was the signing of the G7 Fashion Pact by 32 leading fashion and textile brands, including Ralph Lauren. And protecting the oceans is a specific pillar of this pact. So why is it so important to include oceans in a fashion pact? And how does fashion and the textile industry adversely affect the oceans?
Well, if we want a sustainable planet, we need a sustainable ocean. It's one and the same. And so when it comes to the Sustainable Development Goals from the United Nations, number 14 is life below water. It's about the ocean. But the ocean crosses over all the others, Sustainable Development Goals, in many different ways. So from the fashion industry or any industry, you know, the ocean has to be part of the equation when it comes to sustainable development, because the ocean is critical to sustainable development. The ocean contributes to poverty eradication by creating sustainable livelihoods and workplaces. It's therefore crucial for the global economy and trade, where the G7 Fashion Pact and those leading fashion brands like Ralph Lauren play an important role. It's the ocean's key to solving many of the most challenging tasks that the world faces today. Eradicating hunger and extreme poverty by 2030, for example, fighting disease pandemics like we have today. The role of the ocean is critical for all those things, as well as combating climate change. So I think, yeah, that's in many ways where, you know, if one's talking about sustainable development in any industry, then you've got to look at the role of the ocean and how that plays within fashion. You know, it's into supply chains, it's into the chemicals which are in those supply chains. It's the impact which the company and the supply chain has in terms of the carbon production, and on it goes. You know, there's so many elements to these complex businesses that need to be addressed.
So what are some of the key changes you'd like to see emerge from the G7 Fashion Pact?
First and foremost, it needs to be anchored on science-based targets. Targets to reduce carbon footprint, for example, that are in line with the 1.5 degree pathway that's demanded by the International Panel on Climate Change. And so far, we're seeing, you know, only 20% of the fashion industry is committing to net zero. And if that happens, we'll far exceed the 1.5 or even 2 degree scenario. So I think, yeah, it's the scale and the speed of it as well that we need to look at, because those targets, if achieved by 20%, will be too little too late. The other piece of it is that it's a non-binding and non-obligatory pact. They are mere suggestions. So how do we hold brands accountable to these commitments and to ensure that, you know, these activities are not simply greenwashing? The other sort of big question in the room is around production and questions of overproduction. And that's something which brands often don't really want to talk about. But you know, you're seeing increasingly from consumers that overproduction and fast fashion is less acceptable. And if we want to address these massive systemic challenges that we have, like climate change, then fashion in a way needs to find a way to adapt, to slow down, to factor in those external costs within their supply chain.
Last year, Ralph Lauren launched an Earth Polo shirt created from an innovative fabric produced entirely from plastic bottles as part of their global commitment to use 170 million recycled plastic bottles in their products and packaging by 2025. Why are sustainability efforts like this from brands so important?
Well, business and international businesses are a critical part of the world economy. So the role which they play in sustainability is going to be critical to our future. And as a journalist, I investigated the sustainability strategies of many leading companies. And the vast majority of them do not really get into the engine room where companies can really make the most difference. Far too often, I see that it's the exhaust fumes which they're working on as they seek to greenwash their brand. In my mind, all companies have a basic responsibility to be reducing their carbon footprint and their waste, to be working better with their communities, increasing gender, ethnic diversity, giving through philanthropy, you know, some basic tenets of what good a good responsible business should be doing. But then to really make an effect, you've got to get into the engine of your business. And so what Ralph Lauren are doing on this initiative and more widely across their sustainability program is really getting into sustainable product design. It's looking at how you can eradicate chemicals from the supply chain. It's going into 100% sustainable sourcing, and they're looking to establish measurable targets. And so these are the pillars where I think businesses need to be acting, whether they are not, where they are looking to have a net positive impact on our planet and on humanity, but the only way they can really achieve that is to getting into the engine of their business, working out how their business itself, rather than the fumes that come out of it, can actually create a net positive impact on our planet and on humanity. And that's something that Ralph Lauren looks to be embracing, and I applaud them for their efforts.
You launched Nekton in 2015. Can you tell us about Nekton's mission? Where is your research focused and why do you do it?
Yeah, so quite simply, our client is the ocean. Our mission is to scientifically explore and protect the ocean. So we need, according to many scientists, we need at least 30% of our ocean protected if we want a healthy ocean and a healthy planet. The challenge is that we can't protect what we don't know. A vast majority of our ocean remains unknown to us. So what we try to do is put scientists in the ocean to discover what's there and to find ways to protect it. We're catalysts. You know, we're a small organization. We can't do everything. So we look at seeing how we can create step changes that are needed across the world to affect change. We work very closely with and on behalf of governments of ocean nations, nations who are committed to ocean protection. And then we work with them to codify and then co-deliver missions. And those missions combine applied research, which helps to inform policy. So that's gathering the data for marine spatial planning, for example, and helping to determine the priorities for marine protected areas. Those missions also include knowledge exchange or capacity development, as it's often called, with grants for those host nation scientists, fellowships to international universities, training programs with world experts, the ability for them to participate on field research, also we can build that legacy of long-term sustainable governance. And then a final pillar of what we do is around communications. We're looking to inspire people in host nations, but internationally, with the importance and the value of our ocean. Because if we can do that, that can help strengthen the public support that's needed for political action. It can also help promote sustainable marine tourism, which is often a pillar of the ocean or the blue economy. And we can create a new cadre of ocean leaders. So that's kind of what we do. At the moment, our focus is on the Indian Ocean.
So, Oliver, my next question is, what impact are you and Nekton hoping to have in terms of ocean conservation?
That's a tough question. I mean, there's what's reasonably achievable and what we need. And we work to what the ocean needs and what the scientists tell us we need. And what we need is 30% protected oceans. You know, we need 30% of our oceans protected. So that's the focus of our work, and trying to work across applied science and across knowledge exchange and communications to achieve those goals, which link to those policy and political outcomes. There are lots of other things that need to go on for a healthy and sustainable ocean, whether that's sustainable fishing, whether that's reducing the impact of the amount of carbon dioxide which is being absorbed into the ocean and turned into a carbonic acid, and the acidification of the ocean, whether it's agricultural runoff or industrial chemical runoff into the ocean that's creating massive dead zones across the ocean. There are so many things that need to go on. From our focus is very much on that target of 30% protection by 2030. And at the moment, we only have about 8% of the ocean actually protected. That said, only about 2.5% is protected in what's called highly protected areas. So that's really the baseline of what we need. We only have 2.5% protected, but we need 30%. So our work is focused on the Indian Ocean, where we just started working with the Seychelles, and they've committed to protecting 30% of their ocean. Now that's an area in size to twice the size of the United Kingdom, or the size of Alaska equivalent. On the 26th of March this year, they completed the protection of that area, but also the sustainable development of the rest of their ocean and their ocean economy. So in my mind, Seychelles are a beacon and a bellwether for ocean conservation in the Indian Ocean and globally. There is proof and evidence there from a political perspective, from a scientific and an economic perspective, that marine protection can be implemented and it can work. So it's a very tangible outcome which we look to, and it's a key performance indicator for us to be able to determine, right, where can we succeed and how we can. Our goal now is focused very much on the Western and Central Indian Ocean to try and galvanize 30% protection by 2030. So we start the Seychelles, the next missions with the Maldives. They've committed to at least 20%. And then we're building towards a major summit in 2022, working with the heads of government from the region to commit to a strategy for how we're going to achieve that spatial target of 30% protection.
So Oliver, surely the involvement of other countries across the globe is vital when it comes to getting 30% of the ocean protected.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it needs to be both large nations with their large coastlines, but also those island nations, which may be, and they're often referred to as small island nations or small island developing states, but they are large ocean nations as well. You just look at Seychelles and their vast ocean territory that's nearly 1.4 million square kilometres. Just 30% of their ocean is the equivalent in size to twice the size of the United Kingdom. So these island nations do have large ocean territories, but it has to be a collective effort. One of the interesting things is that the majority of marine biodiversity that's been identified in the ocean to date is around low-income, middle-income nations, who often don't have the funding available to protect or sustainably manage their oceans. But that's where those protected areas really need to be set up. And we've seen nations like the UK and the United States and Canada and a few others, they have been setting up their own protected areas, some around their own around their coastlines, others in their overseas territories as well. So these all help towards that big picture. But we need those nations. But also the other key piece is the high seas, which represents about half of the coverage of our planet is covered by the high seas, or 64% of our ocean. So we need to find a way to sustainably manage and protect the high seas. And that's what's going on at the moment in negotiation at the United Nations, what's called Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction, the BBNJ negotiations, to look at how we can protect the high seas, because that is going to be an absolutely critical component for achieving this goal of 30% protection by 2030.
So industrial fishing practices clearly have a major impact on the ocean's deeper ecosystems. Can we assume that the shallows are also being negatively affected by human activity on the surface? And And what role do the different ocean depths have to play in regulating global climate?
Yeah, all depths of the ocean are affected. We saw from the Five Deeps expedition recently that they've discovered plastics and chemicals in the deep trenches around the world. But certainly, you know, those shallower depths are where we're seeing the absorption of heat, for example. You know, the ocean is getting hotter. It's hotter than it's been for many years, for many millions of years. And that heat obviously goes into the surface water first. To give you some sort of proxy to that, you know, if the ocean and the surface waters hadn't acted as a buffer, the atmosphere on land would already be about 35 degrees Celsius hotter. So that heat absorption piece and the impact that has on those shallow waters is very noticeable, not least related to coral, where you have a heating ocean combined with increased ocean acidification, which is driving the decimation of corals. The heat is a big driver of bleaching of our corals and then decimation of these subsea forests, if you like, which harbour so much of our biodiversity.
So, Oliver, my next question is, for these island states such as the Seychelles and the Maldives, how can we accelerate these conservation efforts? Is it a matter of international pressure from bodies such as the UN to implement these strategies? What's the role of civil society? What's the role of larger coastal states in this effort?
It requires political leadership first and foremost from those nations to understand why it's important to do that. You know, just from a fisheries point of view, for example, the unsustainable exploitation of their fisheries will result in that key pillar of their economy falling away. So countries like Seychelles, Maldives and others, for instance, the sustainable fisheries are fundamentally important for their prosperity and their resilience and their development. So the best way to ensure a sustainable fisheries is to set aside some areas which are protected, because those protected areas act as nurseries for the fishing grounds. And so it's approaching it from an holistic point of view, as through the lens of the blue economy, and saying, right, how can we look to sustain economic growth through the effective management of your ocean? And one of those key pillars is marine protected areas. But also there's the other piece of the blue economy, which is around marine tourism. So if we look at the growth of the blue economy, the OECD report in 2030 has identified that marine tourism will be the single largest sector of the ocean economy by 2030. So the role that marine tourism plays for nations like Seychelles and the Maldives, for instance, is going to be critical. That has to be sustainable marine tourism. And tourists don't want to go and see a wiped out coral reef or no fish or anything else. So again, a healthy ocean supports a healthy marine tourism industry, which helps to underpin the pillars of their economy. So the key question really when picking up the phone to a head of state of any nation, where they want to know, you know, does it make good business sense? What's the economic case for doing this? What's the political case for doing this? What's the scientific case for doing this? Can you provide me with evidence that demonstrates that if we are to do this, this will be a positive outcome for my GDP, for the sustainable management and development of my economy? How will it affect society? And what is the science-based evidence to drive these decisions? If you can make that case, then people are going to listen to you. If you can go to them and say, no, it's not about unsustainable exploitation of your resources. This is about building resilience for a strong and prosperous economy. Then it becomes a very different conversation.
So I want to ask you, why is widespread ocean literacy so important?
Well, we need to inspire people with an understanding and appreciation and value of the ocean. The last time that probably happened on a planetary scale was when we were able to look back at our planet from outer space through the eyes of the astronauts and the cameras on those extraordinary shuttles. And what we saw was that we are a blue planet floating in the inky blackness of space. We realize we are the blue planet. You know, over 70% of the coverage of our planet is ocean. It's the largest biosphere on our planet. Over 95% of our biosphere, where there's life on our planet, is in our oceans. On and on it goes. So people, we need to find ways for people to really understand that we are one ocean and we are one planet. And we need to find a positive, inspirational narrative to be able to engage people with that. And that's part of the challenge. You know, when it comes to storytelling around the oceans, a lot of those stories are very negative. It's about overfishing and exploitation. It's about climate change impact. And on it goes. But Martin Luther King didn't say, "I have a nightmare." He said, "I have a dream." And we have to give people a dream. You have to give people a sense of the beauty and the wonder of the ocean and what can be done to achieve that change. And in my mind, that's what underpins ocean literacy. And we need a narrative which can inspire people. And one of those narratives, you know, is as old as humanity in many ways. You know, it's the stories of exploration and adventure. You look back to the Apollo missions, polar exploration, Jacques Cousteau's adventures, even summiting Everest. Each one of those was a gripping drama, an incredible achievement, overcoming adversity, courage in the face of the unknown. These are positive stories that really speak to a brighter future. And that's what we need. We need an inspirational story of human endeavor that can help inspire people to change their relationship with the ocean. And that is why I think ocean literacy is so important. The story of the ocean is so important, as well as the human exploration of the ocean, which could become such a pillar in inspiring a reimagining of our relationship to the ocean.
So, Oliver, as we draw this conversation to a close, I'm left with this very powerful image of a little boy sitting in a tree holding a brick with an unquenchable sense of curiosity about to do something foolish but also courageous. And so I'd like to ask you as a kind of final thought, what advice would you give to anyone similarly curious who is looking to make positive social impact?
Ooh, that's a bit above my pay station, to be honest, but I'll share my thoughts and experience. And I think what I've learned with Nekton is the positive social impact needs to be science-based, first and foremost. We need to really define the impact that you want to have, define the scale of that impact that you want to have, and define ways that you're actually going to measure that impact. And then look at who can help and who you can work with in partnership, because it's that sense of partnership and bringing together brands and bringing together companies, bringing together civil society or academia or government. It's where people work together that we can have the greatest impact, I believe.
That's a really wonderful note upon which to end. I mean, as you know, the reason we set up The Conduit was to bring together a community of people passionate about positive social change and to bring together big corporations, small not-for-profits, interesting social entrepreneurs, the creative power of entrepreneurship and capital, and a really unshakable desire to make a planet that is more sustainable, more just, and more prosperous, so that our children and our grandchildren think of us as good ancestors. And I am certain that generations who come after you will think of you in that way. And so thank you very, very much for all the interesting work that you are doing. And I hope we can continue to put wind in your sails.
Thank you for inviting me along to share our little story. And hopefully we can find lots of others. It needs to be a massive collective effort. As we're seeing around the world during this distressing time, it's that collective effort towards this planetary emergency that we face, which we need to find inspiring ways to find and navigate the storm so we can achieve that positive impact. And what you're doing at the Conduit Club is fantastic. And if I can support in any way, just let me know.
Thank you for listening to Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on Ralph Lauren's Sustainability Charter or on Ralph Lauren's Design for Change program, visit ralphlauren.com or corporate.ralphlauren.com. And for more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.